deliberations today. It is about 7 minutes after 3. Clock's still not changed, Staff. I'm getting very good at interpreting here, though.
You're not going to do time travel, though, are you?
No time travel. I don't do time travel. Oh, there he is.
Hey, by golly.
The youngest guy, of course. So.
I resemble that jerk.
Hey, woo.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, Jerry, you've been behaving so well. I've.
We're in deep trouble now.
We do have a quorum today. Vice Chair Joe Green, Representative Mulder, Representative Young Jerry Mackey,
old Joe Sitton,
and Chairman Young Bill Hudson here. When you've got the mic, you can say anything you want. And today we're going to take a number of bills up. We'll take up House Bill 539 first, the APUC bill, and we're going to move into the insurance rewrite. We have Mr. Walsh here. That's 534. Last time we met, we heard the first time 458, House Bill 458. This is Representative John Davies' bill that would amend and modify the child support laws that could conceivably bring in perhaps millions of dollars of child support payments that apparently we're losing at the present time. And then we're going to give the committee the first opportunity to hear Senate Bill 64, which Senator Kelly's the prime sponsor of, and right alongside that, we're going to bring up House Bill 241, which is Representative Mulder's sort of companion piece. We'll give everybody an opportunity to kind of hopefully tell the committee what's involved in both sides, and it's not my intention to pass either one of them out. And with that, we'll start with House Bill 539. I believe we have someone from APUC here or on teleconference, Linda?
On teleconference.
On teleconference. Mr. Shore or Mr. Lohr? Did I get that right?
Shore.
I think it's...
Anchorage, do you have...
Have we drafted it into our own form?
All right. It's my understanding... that you may have, we do have an amendment, I believe, before us here, and perhaps you could tell us what you're proposing here, sir. It's this one here, Joe, for the committee, and we are joined by Representative Porter.
Is somebody on?
Okay.
Yeah.
The committee taking a look at the. The procurement of expert witness exemption or amendment that is being proposed here. Do we have a specific amendment or do we have just a conceptual amendment?
Conceptual. I just got this this afternoon from the APUC.
Okay. We would be interested in hearing from APUC on this bill one more time, please.
Chairman Hudson and committee, I'm going to leave Bob Lohr address the procurement of expert witnesses to issue my right-hand expert on this item. Okay.
All right, Mr. Lohr, go ahead, please, sir. For the record, give us your name and your position.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Lohr, LOHR, Executive Director of the Alaska Public Utilities Commission. The conceptual amendment relates to the Procurement Act and would provide an exemption to the Procurement Act very similar to that which is available to state agencies involved in or facing likely litigation in their procurement of expert witnesses. For example, the Department of Law right now is exempt from the Procurement Act for purposes of obtaining expert witnesses for lawsuits. We have an opinion from the Attorney General's office that language is probably not broad enough to cover the Commission's proceedings because they're not lawsuits, they're administrative litigation. And we have a demonstrated record of delays that result from the necessity of going through the steps involved in the procurement proceedings. It has required up to 6 months to get an expert witness months on board from the time that the commission establishes a schedule. And often by the time an expert is available to us, we know who the contract is going to be with. The testimony is already due or nearly due, and we're put into a real time crunch in terms of being able to provide the kind of witness that the commission wants to identify the public interest issue. If the commission were able to procure services directly, then we anticipate that that would not be a problem. That's a quick summary. I'd be happy to give any specifics of examples if you like.
Are there any questions by the members of the committee on the conceptual amendment that's being proposed here? No questions?
Well,
Representative Green?
Are we,
what we have
the title is says relating to regulation of public utilities and to regulatory cost charges. Wouldn't that apply to? I'm just wondering if we're moving outside the
title
here. Everything there is AS-42, and this will be AS-36. Do we need to amend the title? What I'm thinking about the regulatory costs here, I think, are costs by the utilities that are regulated, and this is a cost of the commission, as I understand it.
Let me just, for a minute, Mr. Vice Chair, let me wonder your question here. So what we're looking for is an exemption to the Procurement Act as relates to specifically the employment or contract of expert witnesses. Well, that's a good question. It might require a broadening of the title.
I don't know.
Do we have anybody here, staff?
I can call legal.
Why don't we just get this?
Why don't you do that?
If you adopt, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ulmer?
It would seem that if you adopted conceptually, you'd probably, at that point,
include the necessary
right, it would do a new title amendment that would match it.
Okay.
Well.
Would that satisfy you, Mr.
Chairman? I don't believe, Mr. Chairman, the language that's laid out here is exactly what we would adopt either.
No, I know it isn't. It'll have to be fashioned by the bill drafting people accordingly. All right. You've heard this proposed amendment. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak on the amendment? The chair would entertain a motion.
So moved.
To conceptually adopt whatever necessary changes to implement it. Is that your motion, sir?
Yeah, with the understanding that the bill drafter would make the necessary revisions, Mr. Chairman, I so move.
Any objections? All right, that amendment has been adopted. We now have before us the amended committee substitute, Labor and Commerce, as recently amended here with Ms. Golnos. Do we have any other amendments before the committee? Representative Mackey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is an amendment that's been proposed by it should be in all members' packets. It's got a cover head of ERICA's letterhead, and the amendment is attached to the second page of it, dealing with the liberally construed language issue.
It's in very small type.
Right.
Right.
This I was looking for what lines that for what.
This amendment. Right. It would again be a conceptual amendment. Otherwise, we don't have a fiscal amendment. Right.
That's stated somewhere.
For the interest of the committee, if you will look in your package, you should have a copy of this proposed amendment that was submitted by ERICA. And I'm told by staff that Commerce and Economic Development, APUC, has a separate fiscal note if we do adopt the liberally this amendment, which does add general fund program receipt, $121,400, if we delete the liberally construed provision, otherwise it's zero. Not that that should have changed your mind any, but that's what we're dealing with.
It doesn't surprise me.
So we've heard the motion, then, Mr. Mackey,
I'd like to move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Move the amendment, and I would oppose that for discussion purposes this time, and would ask the views of the committee, Representative Green.
Do we have anybody here that, are you going to carry this or someone else?
No, I was going to suggest, Mr. Chairman, that Mr. Hutchins is here, and also I know we have somebody from APUC. Perhaps if we had one side of each side of the issue, we could dispose of it rather quickly, I would think.
Why don't we ask you, Dave, to come up and tell us, I think we'd probably have this for the record, but let's have it again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Association. And the reason that we had proposed this this amendment, we think it's very important that, as one of our members has put it, that the PUC follow the law rather than make the law. That it's only fair that the regulated utilities know what the rules are, that the rules be consistent with what the legislature has determined they should be, and they're known to everybody. And in the letter that I attached to the conceptual amendment proposal, I gave one illustration of a very big scare we had a year before last on the use of the liberally construed. I would not contend, Mr. Chairman, that the present commission is likely to go astray and do a lot of wild and crazy things using liberally construed. They're simply not that kind of people. It's the finest commission that I've worked with in my 16 years in this position. But I do see this as important in preventive maintenance, if you will, to keep bad old days from coming back again at some time.
Thank you. Don Shore from the APUC, would you like to respond to that, please?
Well, yes, I believe I would. I'm not quite sure. I believe every one of you people have a copy of that. I dropped off there last week when I was doing regarding our position on liberty construed.
Got it.
In addition to that, we know that you were sent a letter on April 5th, signed by Dave Hutchins, in which their attorney enlisted a series of cases where they say that liberty construed was not in other boards and commissions statutes. And then today, I believe you've received, by now you should have faxed down a letter over my signature, which I had our counsel look up a series of other boards and commissions in areas where it is liberally construed. So I guess that's pretty much what makes it stand off. One thing that bothers me in all this is, again, with Mr. Hutchins, high praise of the present commission, I always get really reluctant to talk against it, but I'll try. It's a statement that something may happen, could happen, or might happen. In my estimation, there's been so much bad law and regulation put on the books in the last 20 years without any conscious effort to discuss benefits versus costs on them, because something might or maybe might happen. And if you think back the last 25 years, liberty construed only came up 8 times in the court. Half the time it was ruled for APUC and half the time again. As I stated over in the Senate Labor or Senate Judiciary last week, I don't believe it's broke and it shouldn't be fixed. What it will do is restrict our ability to make decent level-headed decisions without having to go to court or go to the legislature every time we want to make a decision. And one of the reasons you, not necessarily you, but the legislature set up the APUC in the first place is so they didn't have to muck around with every bit of legislation or regulation that goes on in the area of utilities. I guess that's about it, unless you have some specific questions. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Shore? All right. Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair?
Well, we've got this fiscal note now that shows that $121,000 is their Okay, it says Ben, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, is there any way to fashion language to address the concerns that you've stated in that what are the instances that you do need flexibility, and might we be able to, as you know, diminish the liberal translation and more accurately or more focused, with more focused language, address the concerns that you have in relation to what areas you need some flexibility?
Well, it isn't the idea of necessarily needing flexibility. It's just, let me give you a couple examples. Presently, when a utility comes in and asks for operating authority or certification, we just had a recent example of it up in the North Slope with the cellular telephone. They were running up against their FCC deadline for licensing, and if we would not have given them temporary operating authority, they would have had a problem with the FCC. Well, we liberally construed our statute and gave them temporary operating authority. Another area where it's liberally construed in our estimation is when a utility comes in for a rate increase. The law provides we can give them interim rates while the case is being investigated. Well, we make them interim and refundable now and keep an accounting of it. Under the present statute, without being able to liberally construe, the utility would have to put up a bond or set up a separate escrow. And it's in those areas where the flexibility is, it just allows us to better administer the statute under which we work. It does not give us outside authority. My example is if we were a country, it doesn't allow us to go outside our borders. It allows us to do a better job with the statute that's on the books. And if you take it out, you just limit our ability to do a good job and make us more efficient than we possibly already are.
I think probably, Mr. Vice Chair, we've got about five pretty heavy items on the list here today. We have a lot of people from out of town that are here to testify on particularly the last two bills here and telecommunications as well. I think everyone here knows the two sides of this particular issue, and I think it would be the chair's, Senator Porter.
Are we going to continue to debate on the?
I was going to suggest that maybe we go ahead and call for the question. Unless you have some additional, if there's additional information to be derived. Go ahead, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only question I was going to have is, this seemed fairly innocuous. Then all of a sudden it's plowed up a bunch of snakes, and I'm wondering if this kind of a problem is a problem in other states. How do they handle that? Mm-hmm. Either Mr. Hutchins or Mr. Schwer, is there, does this sort of a thing occur in other states?
I'm going to leave Mr. Lohr answer on my behalf because I have not done any research, and I'm not sure if he has or not, Mr. Lohr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My understanding is that liberal construction is quite typical for regulatory agencies, for agencies with a remedial mission, such as workers' comp statutes, that the courts quite typically construe those agencies' statutes broadly for most of the reasons that are identified in the Attorney General's memorandum of April 4th. I don't know specifically how many states have the particular phrase liberally construed in their statutes, but we'd be happy to get that information provided.
I think Mr. Hutchins wanted to respond to
you. Dave, would you like to join us at the table one more time, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have not done any research on what happens in other states, but I can. I did give you a letter from our attorney the other day that talked about what other regulatory agencies within Alaska do. And in their computer research on the question, they didn't find any other state agencies where liberally construed was used in their statute. That the most common directive to the court on how to interpret the statute is the same policy determination that has been suggested to you here. In terms of the question of the transition, so that the commission has the clear authority to do the things they need to do, we have suggested that there be a special effective date on this one section. That would be July 1 of 95. The purpose for that would be to give the commission a year to go through their operations, determine which items they do that they don't really have clear legislative authority to do it, and bring that into the legislature
and the items that they're doing that you agree with, you'd have time to enact that next year before this change in the statute would take effect. So we'd propose that to you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Schor.
If I may, as I mentioned earlier, if you'd review the letter that came in town over my signature today, dated April 7th, it will give you some citing where Alaska courts have used liberty construed in a number of cases. And I would like to make a comment on this one-year extension of 1995. Understand this, we are at your beck and call. We'll play any hand you deal us as far as what the statute should establish. And if the ERICA wishes to put a one-year extension on this bill for us to work, I would suggest that they review the law and make the changes necessary so it doesn't block our activity in treating the public and the utilities in a fair manner. Thank you.
Representative Mackey?
Off of that particular subject, Mr. Chairman, I don't have, first of all, I don't have any problem with the effective date of July 1, 1995. That does give the commission time to bring forward that, and I would suggest that as a friendly amendment, if nobody had an objection, that would not take an immediate effect on them anyway, and I would move that at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Any objections to adding to the amendment that's on the table at the present time, the effective date of July 1, 1995? Hearing none, that's...
Mr. Chairman,
now adopted, amended to the amendment. Representative Mackey.
Continuing, Mr. Chairman, I just want to address the fiscal note. I think in my experience, in my short 4 years, any time an agency or a department doesn't like a bill or an amendment, they give us a fiscal note that reflects their feeling, and I have a feeling this is more of the same. I know that this fiscal note calling for $121,000 is based on the fact that they have to have two assistant AGs for 94 handling their legal issues, and what they're saying is with this amendment it would require half time of one more attorney general to cost another $121,000. First of all, I'd question whether $121,000 was an accurate amount for a half-time assistant AG. If it is, we're all in the wrong business. But second of all, I would suggest that the $121,000 that we spend for the AG's office right now with this amendment could substantially be reduced, because if you didn't have all the liberty construed decisions being made, there wouldn't be that much litigation going on in court. So I think the maybe the fiscal note should reflect a savings versus an additional cost.
All right. Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wrestled with this one over the last three or four days. I've talked with Dave, I've talked with Don, and quite frankly, I'm going to be supporting the amendment, and probably that is for two reasons. One, I got another call that was kind of a tiebreaker from a utility manager in Anchorage that reminded me that when I was on the assembly, we were dealing with this issue, and it was at a time when there were some other people on the commission. And because of things that were going on then, the municipality of Anchorage had some concerns with this particular phrase. There is no doubt, and I will echo what Mr. Hires has said, that I personally have no concern about the implementation of this phrase by the current commission. But fair is fair, and I guess I'm not saying that it's broke either. I'm saying that it needs some long-term preventive maintenance, and that's what I look at this as. I certainly have no concern about the current commission's abilities or use of this phrase, but there was some at one time, and there might be some in the future, so this probably, in fairness, is the best time to change it.
We do have Reed Stoop signed up to testify. We do have the amendment before us. Reed, would you like to testify before we finalize on the amendment? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Reed Stoops on behalf of GCI, and I'll be extremely brief in the interest of time. I testified a week ago on the same issue, and we just wanted to make it clear that at least GCI supports the commission's view and would oppose the amendment. We've butted heads with the commission as much as anybody over the years, but not over this issue. We may disagree with their policy decisions, but we agree with Commissioner Schreier that if this amendment's passed, I think you're going to see more litigation, and the litigation is going to be over whether the commission had the power to do what they just did, at least in the area that we're most concerned about. Telecommunications is changing so rapidly, like the cellular telephone issue that was brought up, and we think that if the commission has narrowly construed powers, we're going to be back to the legislature frequently asking for specific powers for regulation. So I guess we would urge the committee to oppose the amendment.
I think at this time, thank you very much, Reid. At this time, I think the chair has to hand the gavel over to the vice chair and declare a conflict. My son is the general manager of cellular telephone company that was recently benefited by virtue of the liberally construed ability of the APUC to deal with the expansion of his business. And I have nothing to do with the business, absolutely nothing to do with the business, but I do have a relationship there. And I think that, in all fairness, I should declare that conflict and make the committee aware of that.
I believe that this is when everybody in the group says object.
Picture yourself on the floor.
Well, I wanted the records to show that in that particular instance, I think that application was one of the justifications or the reasons that that service was expanded to the North Slope.
I object because I'm concerned what would happen if me and Joe Green got a hold of the gavel.
I'd be glad to take
all
it.
Right, all right, then, since moving right on here, we do have an amendment that has been friendlier amended with an effective date that's before the committee.
Just one point of clarification. I misspoke a moment ago. I said Mr. Hires. I meant Mr. Hutchins. Both H's, right. And they're both utility guys, so yeah. Get them confused.
All that alike.
They all look alike.
And we will now ask the secretary to go ahead and call the roll. Those in favor say aye, and those against nay, please.
Representative Mulder?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
No.
Representative Green?
Mr. Chairman, may I take a liberty during the vote? It is the understanding that with this delayed effective date, it's your understanding as the maker that, and yours as the acceptor, that this would give a year in effect to iron out the problems, and if there is a problem, come back for the next legislative session. Aye.
Representative Mackey?
Yes.
Representative Sitton?
Aye.
Representative Porter?
Yes.
Representative Hudson?
No.
5 yeas, 2 nays.
And so the amendment has passed as amended, and we now have before us Committee Substitute House Bill number 539, Labor and Commerce, as amended here today with fiscal note, what would you designate this thing, 1193, revised 1193. Anyway, it's the one that shows in fiscal year 96, 121.4. The chair would entertain a motion to dispose of this bill. Representative Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass Labor and Commerce CS for HB 539 with fiscal notes from Labor and Commerce Committee with individual recommendations.
As amended?
As amended.
Are there any objections?
No more testimony from the public.
We have no indication.
Sitting right here is a list with my name on it on top.
I'm sorry. Are you Steve Kahn?
Yes, I am.
Steve, we will freeze everything in motion and take your testimony, sir. I'm sorry. I thought I had everybody on here, but I didn't catch your name. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Stephen Kahn. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Public Interest Research Group. I'm here to speak in opposition of House Bill 539. In recent days, to wit, on March the 9th, a special public meeting was held by the APUC in which substantial testimony and commentary was given on the subject of independent consumer representation before the APUC. I wish to supplement my brief oral comments with a transcript of that hearing. I realize that the committee on another subject on another bill has received a summarized version of that hearing as well as a fiscal note on that bill, which is not the subject today. However, this hearing reveals, as no other hearing that I have read to date, that the APUC has lost contact entirely with the principle that the regulatory cost charges, which are a tax upon the ratepayers, require them to take, to be in the forefront and to take a very advanced stand on consumer representation and utility matters. As this hearing will indicate to you, if you and your staff are able to review it, the regulatory cost charges are viewed as a subsidy for the continuing cozy relationships between the utilities and the APUC. The regulatory cost charges represent taxation without representation on the part of paid for by consumers who deserve better than they're getting. And I won't go into any further details because the hearing summarizes, the transcript summarizes how few consumers make complaints, how limited are the resources for them to make complaints, how limited is staff resources when it comes to making a formal complaint or a state complaint. And all of this speaks volumes, as I cannot speak and will not speak today, about the problem with the fundamental principle that ratepayers should underwrite an APUC which is indifferent to the needs of those self-same ratepayers in the way they do their business. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve, and my apologies for not picking it up. I had several folks indicated testifying here, and I thought you were down for 458, and that's the reason I didn't pick it up. We had your name in proper order. I just didn't pick it up correctly. So
thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
All right. We are going to continue opening, leave this open just for another minute or two here for further testimony, and I think that since we had already moved on the bill, in fairness to the public that did not testify and has not testified yet, I would like the committee's approval to essentially repeal our vote, our recent ascension, to go ahead and move the bill so that we can hear one further testimonial on this, and then we'll take the final action one more time. And with that, Jim Rowe, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Jim Rowe. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Telephone Association. I want to thank you for letting me have the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon and go on record that ATA does support the amendment. We appreciate the concern that Mr. Hutchins mentioned here, and we do appreciate very much the current commission, and we have great faith in them. However, we realize that this is not talking about the individuals who are currently on the commission. And we have had concerns in the past. Individual members of ATA have had concerns in the past where liberally construed has seemingly abused power that had to be decided in court. And we realize this can happen in the future when we have a less professional commission sitting. And we would support the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Any questions of Mr. Rowe, only, sir? Thank you. Anyone else? While we're in a liberal mood here, I'd like to testify. All right, that brings the bill as amended with the fiscal notes back before us. Chair would entertain another motion to go ahead and final our action. Representative Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, again, I would move the House Labor Commerce CS for H.5539 as conceptually amended with amended fiscal notes from the committee with the recommendation.
Any objection? So moved.
Motion gets in the script.
Next, we will take up the omnibus insurance bill, House Bill 534. You remember, this is a rather comprehensive bill. And we did hear this for the first time, and I think Mr. Walsh is with us again. Mr. Walsh, would you like to join us again, Dave?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is David Walsh. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance. With me is the usual list of suspects from the division who have worked on this bill, and I and they are prepared to answer any questions that the chair or members of the committee may have.
Go ahead, please.
He's prepared to answer any questions.
Well, go ahead and answer them.
Okay. 12, 4, and on page 17 at the bottom.
Very good. He's ahead of me. I can tell you that right
now. All the amendments were rolled into the CO.
What was the question?
What is the age of consent?
This clearly is not only the omnibus, it's got a different name, too.
Mr. Chairman, there has been a substitute prepared, a committee substitute, based upon the amendments we proposed at the last hearing, and I believe that all those amendments were included. From our perspective, the bill is in fine shape, and we recommend it for your consideration.
The committee does have the amended version, the draft version that includes all of the amendments that were proposed and adopted at the last sitting here. So now we have the final version before us. The chair has not received any concerns expressed from outside by anyone on 534. Any questions or? Representative Mulder, did you have something?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, have you gotten any feedback from any, obviously, the companies that are involved are much more closely attuned to the concerns than we would be in relation to insurance. Have you got any concerns reflected to you at all from any of the insurance companies?
The concerns that we had were all contained in the amendments that we proposed to the committee last time. Our criteria for something making it into this bill was that it had to be something that was non-controversial. There are all sorts of little things in a title as big as Title 21 that need to be done. And as opposed to introducing 20 bills, we decided we would roll them into one bill. But we wanted to make certain that it met the needs that needed to be met without doing anything that would attract any controversy to the bill. This is a substantive bill as opposed to just a procedural one, but we do see it as a cleanup bill and not one that that fundamentally changes anything in terms of the way we do business.
Representative Green.
Dave, there's a rumor in the halls that you actually had 8-5 that you couldn't make a bill longer than the tort reform bill. Is there?
I do have 22 pages of amendments that I need to put on the bottom so to get it to 82.
Any other questions? Well, anyone else in the audience?
Doing that, I would like to make a comment for the record that
please, go right ahead.
Mr. Walsh came by since I had some concerns about the bill, came by and was very patient in explaining many of the questions I had, and that's to his credit. I really appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, thank you. You too.
The record show the vice chair can carry this on the floor of the House.
I can't carry it down here. God, there's a need on the bus to carry it up.
Right. All right, we now have the, we do have the 33094 version, e-version of the committee substitute House Bill number 534, Labor and Commerce, before us with fiscal notes. It's the wishes of the committee. Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we pass HB 534 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note, I believe.
Are there any objections?
Thank you.
So moved. Next, we'd like to ask Representative Davis to join us at the table to present to us, I believe, a slightly modified House Bill 458. My apologies first to John. I recognize that you had a limited period of time on teleconference before, so we'd be happy to take your testimony at this time and tell us what you've done with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize that my schedule meant that I had to leave the teleconference in midstream there. I was hoping to be able to speak to you about it last Tuesday when you had it scheduled originally. I understand that my staff presented the bill to you reasonably well, so I won't repeat that, okay. That testimony, except that one of the issues that was raised at the last meeting was I believe by Representative Porter, the question of what's substantial compliance. And I believe that you have an amendment in your packets that was prepared to address this concern, and I trust that it does. If the committee wishes, I'd be happy to have it moved.
Representative Porter, I believe this was an area that you brought to the attention of the staff.
This would seem to plug the hole that appeared liberally construed that $1 a year could suffice. And I think this basically is the suggestion that we had was 1 month's worth for them.
Yeah, I believe my staff worked with yours to get this together.
Great.
So then we have the committee steps to House Bill number 458. I believe this is properly. We did adopt this before. If not, the record should reflect that. And we do have this amendment that is now before us. Representative Porter, you saw.
Mr. Chairman, I would move, having written a number one on it, amendment number one.
Question?
The amendment number one is the amendment, page 7, lines 19 through 20 for staff and the record. Representative Williams, sir.
I know we, I think at our last meeting we talked about strengthening it even more so and having the department, didn't the department talk about making it a little stronger than this?
Well, I think we debated it back and forth. The I think this reflects what I felt was kind of the consensus at the time. What this would do would establish that partial payment would be at least 1 month's, the equivalent of 1 month's out of 12 months period payment.
Rather than just a dollar.
Rather than just any partial payment.
So after $2,000, I think the number was
after $2,500.
$2,500, they can owe $2,500 for forever, and you know, as long as they make 1 month, and then they keep current after that. Is that
Representative Davies? Did you understand the question, sir?
Yeah, I think I do. I believe that the main effect of this bill is really to get people's attention. And that if you engage people in a dialogue, that in over 80% of the cases that you get satisfactory outcome. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that I'm too concerned about this particular definition because one way or the other. I mean, I think that it's better the way it is. I think this represents kind of a compromise between various versions that you could imagine. And I think that the main issue is to identify the folks who are significantly in arrearage and to engage them in a dialogue about what kind of payments would be reasonable and when they can make them.
All right, thank you. Does that answer your question, Representative Williams? Okay. Representative Green?
If a person fits this position, now he's 25, he's less than 2,500 past due, and he makes a payment or makes a series of payments, the cumulative amount of which is equal to or greater than, as this says, the amount due for 1 month. So he's paid, let's say, a tenth.
And it makes more than 2,500.
Huh? Yeah, he owes no more than $2,500, and he's made it something less than one.
If he owes less than $2,500, this bill doesn't kick in. If he owes more than $2,500,
the applicant has no more than $2,500 past due.
He is in substantial compliance. Consequently, they will not be holding up his.
Okay, my point. That's not my issue.
Oh,
the issue is that he makes the payment cumulatively, or maybe in a lump sum. Does his then 12 months start over again, or is it a running 12 months?
Mm-hmm. That's what I was trying to get.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean,
okay.
I was
Representative Davies, sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Green, I think, Representative Green, I think that the issue would come up at each license renewal, and it would be in the previous 12 months relative to that license renewal.
So, Mr. Vice Chair, as I understand it, the trigger is when this self-employed individual goes in to renew his license, his or her license, the search would be made, and if they found that they were substantially out of compliance, they would be held off for 150 days or whatever that figure is, and hopefully be made whole, or they would make the situation right.
Okay, thank you.
Is that correct?
I think that's correct.
All right, we do have a few others would like to speak on this bill. We'll take Kenneth Kirk.
Have we voted on amendment number one?
No. Let's do that. Let's go ahead and take up amendment number one at this time. That's a good idea. Would you move it, sir?
I did.
All right.
We were under discussion.
All right. Amendment number one is before the body. Any objections to amendment number one? Amendment number one has been adopted. And I think now we'll go out to Kenneth Kirk in Anchorage.
Thank you. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Loud and clear, sir.
Okay. We haven't seen the amendment up here. I think the aide here typed a request into the computer, but we don't know what the amendment says, so I can't address that. I have reviewed the bill itself. This is bad law for a variety of reasons. But first, let me establish two points. First of all, not everybody with an arrearage is morally culpable or deserving of punishment. There are a variety of situations in which someone can get into arrears without having done anything wrong. For example, and yet CFPB claims to be able to go back 7 years and collect six years worth of arrearages. There are situations where people informally change custody and find out only later that because they didn't get the court order changed in the meantime, they're actually liable for child support arrearages for a period in which they had the child. There are people who lose jobs and can't afford to get an attorney to go in and change their order for a while and end up building up an arrearage. There are people who are seasonal workers. The courts, who of course get paid every month, the judges do, they expect them to budget accordingly throughout the year. If they have a bad season, oftentimes they get behind during the off season. There are situations where the custodial parent kidnaps or hides the child, and so the other parent stops paying for a while to try to smoke them out. There are a variety of other situations. Most of the obligors who come to me, and I do a lot of child support work, most of them have some kind of good reason for being behind. Those reasons are not generally legally recognized. Typically, there's not a whole lot I can do about the bulk of the child support arrears. The second point I'd like to make is that the child support laws, the laws that establish whether one has an arrearage, are extremely rigid. The law says that the judges cannot retroactively modify arrearages. The child support guidelines are applied very formulaically. Despite some language that says that the judge can vary it, it's almost never varied. And there are very few situations where fairness or equity is a defense. Most of the time, if I get somebody off on a part of their arrearages, it's because of a technicality, not because it was right. And oftentimes, it's right that the person get off, but I can't get them off because there's no mechanism for fairness or equity to apply. Given that, this bill has some specific problems. First of all, I don't know why the DA was used unless they were copied from another state's laws. Right now, the DAs in Alaska have practically nothing to do with child support laws, and to bring them in is, I think, going to cause some problems. Second, there doesn't seem to be any mechanism for an administrative appeal, so what I assume is going to happen under this is that we're going to have one person at the DA's office at any given location who's got the authority make the settlement agreements.
Mr. Kirk?
Yes.
This is Representative Hudson. We're operating from the work draft dated 2/24/94. Staff tells me that they believe your testimony is no longer contained in the bill. The bill has been revised.
Well, that's the only one they have up here is the draft of 2/9/94. And we only found out about this thing this morning. Nobody seems to have bothered to inform various groups are very interested in this, and the only one they have up here is 2994.
Well, we're dealing from 2-24-94. The best we can do, if they don't already have a copy up there, is to fax you up one.
Hold on. I'd appreciate that.
My understanding from the telecommunications staff here is that it's on its way up there now. And
okay. Let me, the chair would allow me to reserve a minute to just sort of conclude here, and then maybe after I've looked at that, if I have any other specific comments. I guess the only thing I'd like to say in closing is that the real solution to child support parity, aside from some things Mr. Arneson I know is going to talk about, is to get CSED off of its butt. It takes forever to get anything done at CSED, whether it's getting a phone call returned, which can take a week, getting a revision of your child support order, which can take a year, 2 years, or just getting them to go after somebody for paternity, which can take 5 or 6 years. If they get on these things and inform people early on, most of them would meet their obligations or at least establish that dialogue that someone earlier said they wanted to establish.
Thank you, Mr. Kirk. We will go ahead and move on to some of the other testimony, and you should receive a copy of the 2-24-94 work draft version, and if you take a look at it, and if you still wish to add another measure, we can take another minute or two of your testimony. next, I think what we'll do is we'll take Juanita Hensley here in Juneau. Then we'll come back out to the Anchorage LIO. That'll give Anchorage, those folks up on the teleconference, time to get the revised draft before you. So, Juanita, did you wish to? No, you're here for questions, right? You want to talk too?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think I do for just a couple of seconds, if you don't mind. For the record, my name is Juanita Hensley. I'm with the Division of Motor Vehicles. The department just received this CS at 1:55 this afternoon. I have, up until that time, did not know that it even existed. The way the work draft is written, I do see that there are going to be some major problems with the Division of Motor Vehicles trying to comply with this. We do feel that it is definitely a substance that needs to, and an issue that needs to be dealt with, and we are in support of something that will get deadbeat parents to pay their child support. But the way this is drafted, it says on page 6, line 29, driver's license or endorsement to operate a commercial motor vehicle or school bus. That's all driver's licenses in the state of Alaska. As of February of this year, we have a total of 462,000 licensed drivers in the state of Alaska. We issue approximately 200,000 a year. And with trying to comply with the sections 1 of this bill and the notice requirements, it is going to impact the division immensely. And so at that, I would like to ask for additional time to be able to kind of digest this, and before I could actually say what the actual fiscal impact is going to be on the department. We would prefer that some language be put into Section 1 where the agency would be required to report to the division in an electronic measure, as opposed to leaving it abroad as to could be interpreted that it could be a paper list of people to us. Just having a short time to go over this, it hasn't given me a lot of chance to digest the full impact on the division. But I did want to speak to that.
Juanita, would you be able to more fully respond to it if we were to carry it over until Tuesday, I guess, would be the next week, bring it up at that time? Would you be prepared to address it at that time?
Mr. Chairman, I would say yes, that we could address it at that time. I will. I am going out of town for a federal conference tomorrow evening. I will not be back in town until next Thursday morning. However, I will make sure that my director is aware of this and that he the deputy director could respond to the concerns the Division of Motor Vehicles does have on this. So there would be someone available by teleconference if that's possible.
For the committee's interest, of course, the bill does go on to the judiciary, Brian, and I think finance as well. I find this a substantially important piece of legislation myself. That's the reason I hurried to bring it aboard. So we're all kind of operating under the gun a little bit here.
Mr. Chairman, such
an immense problem that I'm really inclined to try to at least keep it moving along if we can.
Mr. Chairman, we do agree with the concept of this, and there is the Federal Child Support Enforcement Act that was going to impact the Division of Motor Vehicles nationwide quite a lot. And the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators worked with Congress on amending that bill right now as it stands to where the motor vehicle agencies would not be issuing driver's licenses or registration of vehicles to individuals who were in arrears upon the issue of a warrant against the person. And we worked strongly to get the revocation of a driver's license out of the bill and to make it to where it was workable and not impacting the Division of Motor Vehicles nationwide as well as this. We do agree with the concept of the bill, and we do think that it is something that we can work with, but we would just like to be able to work with the agencies to make sure that we have something that's not going to impact the Division of Motor Vehicles to a point where we're going to have more people stand in line.
So, Representative Sitton.
I was just going to observe, Mr. Chairman, that we do have two more committees, I believe, and I think the division would have ample opportunity, and certainly those committees would be amenable to hearing from you and the important function you play in this question. So it'd be my wish to move this on out of here, Mr. Chairman, and myself.
Representative Porter.
Chairman, unless...
I do have other testimonies.
Well... Yeah, I go ahead and complete the testimony, and then I just have an observation about whether this is going to make it at all anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you, Juanita. Kit Ballantyne.
For the record, my name is Kit Ballantyne. I'm the Acting Director of the Division of Environmental Health with the Department of Environmental Conservation. We would have the same concerns that Juanita had in regard to the impact of the reporting requirements and tracking for the applications that we, approvals that we, in the department issue. That would be the fiscal impact. We believe that if it's done on, say, on a quarterly basis, it would not have a significant impact.
All right. Conceptually, though, Kit, do you... Do you understand and agree with the intent of the bill, for the record?
For the record, yes. There's no, we don't oppose that.
Sherry Gall?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sherry Gall. I'm representing the Alaska Women's Lobby and KIDPAC to speak in support of this legislation, which we feel is really needed. Anything that we can do to help collect the over $300 million that are owed to Alaska's children would be a wonderful effort and certainly help in the overall picture. This legislature has taken, you know, steps towards trying to decrease dependency on the public. For families who are left in this situation, and I guess one of the best ways to do that would be to make parents be responsible for their children, and I think this is one way to certainly do that. And I understand the concerns of the Department of Motor Vehicles and the other agencies who are responsible, but I would note that one of the ways that the Child Support Agency had been found somewhat deficient in the federal audit was that they had not used the Department of Motor Vehicles as a locator source often enough. You know, it was one of the underutilized sources for locating a parent who was in arrears. So I hope that the introduction and hopefully the passage of this legislation will help those two agencies to coordinate their efforts more.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Carl Luck, Director of Occupational Licensing. I'd just like to reiterate also the impact on our division this bill, but I think there is a way that it could be reversed. Right now, the way the CS is written, we do the comparison. We identify the people that have a license that are on their list from revenue. We send out a notification upon finding that person, and this is done on a monthly basis, not upon renewal or upon application, but upon a monthly basis when we get the list, whether it be on paper or electronically. We then have to issue a 100 or a 150-day license. We could turn that around, and the impact on my division would be very little then, if we provided to revenue our list of licensees, and they did the match, and they did the notification, and they did all the processing, and then notified us that license number such and such has a hold on it until released by their agency. And then our impact would be down to one person.
Carl, would you be able to delegate the authority for them to issue the licenses, however temporarily?
Mr. Chairman, no. We would have to issue the temporary license, but issuing a temporary license is not the impact that I see. It's identifying who is the person on the list in comparison with our list, since we cannot require Social Security numbers. And right now we have a 5,000 match based on names alone. I think it's 4,000 based on names alone run against this program. And there's a 1,350 match based on names and birth dates and so and addresses. So we're looking at least 1,350 actual cases that by this computer match now, that we would have to go in and determine whether this is the right person. And of course, we're going to get sued if we pick the wrong doctor because he has a similar name and similar address. And so that would be an impact. But if that responsibility is on the agency whose task this currently is, then our concern would be much less. We would just put they would notify Dr. So-and-so that his license will not be renewed until he comes into compliance, give us a hold. We entered into the computer so that no renewal can occur, and then it would stay there until that hold was released. Mm-hmm. We have about 100,000 licenses, and so we got to bang up this list of 50 against 100,000. And there may be another impact. I believe that we will no longer be able to issue over-the-counter service for business licenses based on this. Right now, we issue over-the-counter services in three different locations. And it's basically you come in, you fill out a form, and you get a number. Your name and form and information may not be entered into the computer because there's a very long link between here and Fairbanks computer-wise. And because of just the press of business, it doesn't necessarily get into the computer. But by this, we could not issue that number until we did a check. And so I see an impact of over-the-counter service being provided. But again, if we reverse the responsibility back to the agency, we would still, I think, be impacted by over-the-counter services because a new name comes in, just walks in the door, there's still going to have to be this check made for that new person. Never previously licensed for a business license. If you omit business licenses, if you refine this down to where it's only professionals, the impact is much less.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, would you like to come forward, please? Lorraine Durr.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Lorraine Durr. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, and I have administrative control or administrative responsibility for child support. And as we were reviewing the legislation and looking at the fiscal impact, and we went through the list on page 6, I think we came up with 10 different departments that this legislation affects and lists of licenses in the various commissions, departments, boards, everybody that works with licenses. So the impact not only affects Division of Occupational Licensing, Motor Vehicles, pardon me, the DEC, but impacts a lot of a lot of different departments. I think you've all heard about the backlog in CSED, and I guess I think that if we turn this back to the agency, it will create a bigger impact. I think we're only going to be able to solve this problem if we all work together. And through the division director and I sat down yesterday and explored how we might look at this, checking the licenses and so on, and the walk-ins. And we thought perhaps we're going to have to explore something like everybody's got a PC that's hooked in, so you've got a wide area network or something. So someone in occupational licensing can go into the database, or we're going to have to do something electronic through tapes. It's going to have to be a big concerted effort. As we look at this and look at the fiscal impact, as the lady from Motor Vehicles said, they would need more people. What we need to do is look at those costs department by department. They can be all rolled into a fiscal impact that the federal government will share 66% with. What it would entail is a concentrated effort looking at costs, putting it into the division, into child support division, and then RSAing the money back out so that we could get a match on, federal match with the money. But it's not a simple solution, and I don't think the simple solution is turning it back to child support because of trying to get everything caught up in child support the way it is, and if we impact them with another piece of legislation with this degree of impact, I think it will maybe hinder rather than help what this legislation does.
When would you and the other agencies, without legislation, be able to take this concept and pursue it anyway without new legislation? Couldn't you do that administratively?
I would think so. I think it's just, again, it's one of those monumental efforts when people are working, at the pace they're working at, and it's just another thing to do. And we try to work with licenses. I mean, we try to do some of that right now. But, again, I think you need the impact of the law behind it.
I don't think you could hold it up without the law.
You couldn't hold it up without
it? I don't think you could hold up the license without the law.
Mm-hmm.
Although you're talking about the issuance of the licenses,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's right. You'd have to have authority to do that, mm-hmm. Legal authority to do that.
And I think, as Mr. Luck mentioned, the liability of occupational licensing, I mean, the liability for making a mistake would be the same with CSED. The state is still making a mistake, whether it's the Department of Administration or the Department of Revenue that's making the mistake. It's just that identification is critical regardless of where it rests.
Thank you very much. We're going to go back out to Jim Arneson. If you could make it brief, please. We're going to try to dispose of this bill.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jim Arneson, and I represent the Alaska Family Support Group. We are in receipt of this latest coffee, and we appreciate that. We thank you for that. I still have a problem with one of the amendments that have been made, but I'll just briefly mention my comments on this bill. I'm not really in favor of this bill, and I believe most of the people I represent would not be in favor of this also. This bill can be equated to a resumption of instituting a form of debtor's prison, and that will be self-defeating by virtue of the fact of removing the ability of a debtor to maintain a livelihood in order to pay the monies that you seek to collect. Draconian measures such as this tend to attack symptoms rather than affect a cure. The problem will remain unless we look to the cause of the problem, which is directly correlated to visitation issues. Roughly the same percentage of obligors that we call deadbeats, the people that don't pay child support, are the ones that don't have visitation or relationships with their children. In cases where parents do have relationships with their children, I'll just give you some statistical information. Over 90% compliance rates are achieved when both parents have real good visitation, such as joint custody. In shared custody situations, the compliance rate is 80%. When parents don't have good visitation, the compliance rate is below 40%. Trying to collect money in a manner such as this, I think you're just attacking symptoms, and there are a number of questions like Mr. Kirk brought up in regards to paternity suits, where all of a sudden an obligor who did not know he had a child all of a sudden gets hit with a $50,000 bill. This latest addition, if the obligor has no more than $2,500 past due and has made at least one payment or partial payment in the last 12 months, well, how does that affect somebody that all of a sudden gets hit with a $50,000 bill from CSED on a paternity action that some girlfriend he had 10 years ago? I think we need to address that situation. And then one other comment I would have is at the very end of the bill where you mentioned that some kind of a review should be done as to how this affects the enforcement and collections. I don't see that there's any criteria where the agency or division or there should be some sort of information feedback as to actually how much more money this legislation would collect. In other words, what kind of benefit can we see from it? You mentioned the number of delinquent obligors and number of licenses and renewals and so forth, but we need to have some kind of a cost equation here, find out what kind of cost effectiveness this will bring by determining just how much more money you'll actually bring in if you institute this. I really don't think that taking away licenses from people in this manner is a good idea. I think you have to look at the situation from a realistic viewpoint. People need these licenses to make money. If you take that ability away, then how are you going to get the money out of these people? I think we create a bigger problem than the one we're trying to solve. And I firmly believe in child support. I think we need to support our children, but I think we need to do it through more stricter enforcement and visitation. I think this is a very narrow way of looking at the problem that we have, and it's a serious problem indeed. But I think the problem is not related to the collection of child support. It's related to the lack of visitation, the lack of parenting arrangements with children that are necessary for parents to be involved and responsible. And that's where we should be looking at. Thank you very much for taking the time to listen to my testimony.
Thank you much, Mr. Arneson. With that, the chair is going to make a decision at this end that we will hold this bill over and charge the sponsor with hopefully trying to wrestle some of the things that we heard here. Representative Davies?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could respond to a little bit of that. I think it might perhaps allay some of your concerns. With respect to the first and the last person who spoke, they both raised the issue of arrearages. And you have to distinguish between arrearages and payments. What it says in the bill is that you're only not in compliance if you're behind in your payments. So if you're hit suddenly with a new identification, you're not behind in your payments at that point. So you would still have a whole year to come in compliance, and you'd have to a year would have to transpire, and you'd have to fall $2,500 behind in your payments before this would kick in. So the concern that they've raised there, I don't think is an issue. And with respect to the main point, the issue, the debtor prison comment, what I can say about that is that the experience in other states is that about 80% of people come into compliance within this 150-day window. And so it's really, it's the dialogue that I was talking about. The point is to identify people and engage them in the dialogue. The point is not to be punitive or take their licenses away. It's to hold a little bit of a stick over them while you have a dialogue. And I think that the experience in other states has been that that's been very effective. Also, there are other states, and you probably have this in your backup, but let's see, Maine, Minnesota, South Dakota all require, for example, checks against all driver's licenses. And their experience, Minnesota reports essentially no extra cost in administering it. Maine says the costs incurred are far less than the total that they've collected to date. So they say far less. South Dakota says that they did have to do a considerable amount of computer programming to get it started, but they didn't. All of the states recommend that there be an automated administrative system in place. That's the reason why we changed the bill from the involving the DA to just having an administrative process. The experience in other states has been that that was the right way to go. I believe that and I don't have any problem with the issues that DMV and DEC raised or occupational licensing. I think that those issues can be resolved in a fairly straightforward way.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but we do have a couple of other bills that we want to try to take up today. I think that you need to get together, particularly with the agency. We've heard Captain Luck, Carl Luck, talk about a suggestion there, and there was some opposition or at least some concern expressed by other agencies here. Rather than spend the committee's time on it any further here, we're going to have it come back with some of these answers before I would feel comfortable in sending it on out. Representative Mulder?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also appreciate it, Representative Davies, if you could work with the Department of Fish and Game. As I was looking at it, you know, we've addressed a bill earlier in this committee which about refinancing loans for commercial fishing. And I think this would dramatically affect some of those people as well, as that was a controversial element within that bill. And I think it would behoove you to address their concerns as well, because certainly many of these people could be disenfranchised from their occupation through a maneuver or through an effort like this as well. And that's certainly not what you're trying to do either.
Right.
I appreciate that. I think it's an important consideration to throw in the equation.
I think they're going to take it up in this committee again.
I guess, Mr. Chair, my concern is that I believe that these issues can be addressed in a fairly straightforward manner. It would take me about a day. The problem is that if it doesn't advance right now, you've effectively killed it for the year.
Representative Porter,
I don't think that this is going to advance in any event. My understanding of our schedule is that Finance may have their bills and rules by Monday. The rest of us committees have to have our stuff in by tomorrow, and close of business tomorrow. So we couldn't get through here and through noticed and through judiciary in a day.
Mr. Chair, it would be conceivable that it could be waived through judiciary and into finance. And finance has scheduled it pending referral. So.
Could be, but with the questions that we've had here unanswered, I can tell you it will not be waived through.
Okay. Fine.
I still would like to, John. I think that the bill has a substantive merit. I think that if you could get together with DMVA or not DMVA, but yes, motor vehicles. And some of the other agencies, and try to at least iron out some of those questions. I'd be willing to bring it back up the next time we meet, if you could be prepared to do that. And we'll take another shot at it. It may or may not have any ability to pass on. I suspect that Representative Porter is absolutely right. That's what we've all been told, essentially, that if it isn't going to move forward, or if it isn't going to make it up into rules by a certain date, it probably isn't going to make it, because we're down to day 31 or 32 here. So, but at any rate, that's my ruling, is that we are going to hold it over and ask you to try to see if you can answer some of those questions for us, and then we'll decide what we're going to do with it at the next.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll do that.
Thank you very much. So this bill then is held over. We'll now take up 64 first, and then following that, we'll hear 241.
Josh is here for Senator.
All right. Josh Peck, here for Senator Kelly. And then I think we've got some other folks here to, we're going to sponsor right on our committee here. Fink, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Josh Fink. I'm a legislative aide to Senator Kelly. He would be here himself, but he is up running his Senate Labor and Commerce meeting on the second floor. I'll try to keep my comments brief, Mr. Chairman. In 1988, the legislature passed a comprehensive revision of Alaska's workers' compensation laws. At that time, it was considered model legislation and was built around a no-fault system. Since taking effect, the new workers' compensation provisions have proven successful. However, In 1989, the Supreme Court held in Van Bean versus ERA Helicopters that, and I quote, workers' compensation carrier could be held liable to estates of deceased pilots for negligent performance of safety inspection if insurer actually inspected the working conditions of the employer prior to the incident. That ruling effectively ended the no-fault system. The unintended result is that carriers are now unwilling to perform safety inspections. Alaska workers are at greater risk of injury. We have a less safe, or I should say more dangerous, work environment. Insurers simply will not provide safety inspections if they are to be held liable. This bill would remove insurers, insurance service agents, self-insured employers, and trade associations from civil liability for damages resulting from the performance or failure to perform a workplace safety inspection or safety advisory service unless the act is intentional or negligent. SB 64 ensures workplace safety inspections will continue, that workers' compensation insurance will be available and affordable because of safety inspections, and that employees benefit from a safer work environment. Senator Kelly really considers this a correction, or considers it continuing in the spirit of the 1988 reform. A new no-fault system was set up. This decision allows a way around that. You can't go after the employer, you can go after his insurer, and that was not the intent at all in 1988. So I can answer any questions.
Other questions of the committee? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Others who wish to testify on this bill? Yes, Mr. Hutchison. Thank you, Dave. I do see your name here.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Association. And I might take just a moment, if you will permit, Mr. Chairman, to explain that while you're used to seeing me in front of you for energy bills or utility bills or that sort of thing, it comes as a surprise to some of our friends to see me up on a workers' comp bill or an insurance bill. I need you to understand that one of the most important programs of our state association we started a long time ago is an insurance program, which in 83 evolved into a reciprocal insurer, which is a regulated insurance company chartered under the laws of the state of Alaska and regulated by Mr. Walsh's division. And so we're around on those bills as well. In this particular instance, the Van Bean issue, the impact is doubly significant for us because we have had before the Van Bean decision a very intensive safety program for our member utilities. It's operated through the state association, but it's funded by funds transferred over from our insurance operation. And so both entities are at risk for a lawsuit that could come up under the Van Bean decision. And with both entities virtually at risk of bankruptcy, with that kind of unlimited liability, we did, in fact, have to stop doing anything in our safety program that could be described as a worksite safety inspection. And it's a very uncomfortable, very untenable position for us to be in, Mr. Chairman. We're begging and pleading that there be some correction to this problem. Senate Bill 64 would be one way to do it. Section 2 of House Bill 241 would also do it. This is a really very serious problem for us and the people who work for our members. We have plans to go back into a much more aggressive safety program as soon as there is a correction to this problem. In a real world, in the ideal world, there should not be a necessity to have a trade-off to get the authority to do safety work. But we realize that we live in the real world, not the ideal world, and we've seen that there are trade-offs that are necessary politically to be able to get what we need to do to be able to provide safety services. We've been sitting here all session hoping that the kind of arrangement, kind of agreement could be reached that would permit this this important legislation to be passed in one form or another. So we're getting very discouraged, Mr. Chairman, that the session is about over and we're about out of time and there's still no resolution to the problem. We are hopeful that by scheduling this, and I would hope move both bills along, that perhaps that would provide the incentive for people to get together and work out their differences and get some legislation enacted this session. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Green?
This is just for my own edification, Dave, but did the Van Bean decision apply only to the inspector, or would it transfer then, because he's an employee, to the employer as well?
Mr. Chairman, the decision affected Wausau Insurance Company as the insurance company who had underwritten the workers' compensation policy for the employer in that particular instance. And so it was Wausau that the state Supreme Court ruled could be sued for the alleged possibly alleged negligence of the inspector.
Okay, so it's the insurance company.
Up until that time, it had always been assumed in the state that anyone, whether it's the insurance company or others, like a trade association, who were doing safety services on behalf of an employer, enjoyed the same restriction, same limitation from liability, same exemption from liability that the employer itself had. And the Van Bean decision was the first time there was a break in that.
Thank you, David. Representative Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, Dave, quick question. Mr. Bundy, it's not representative, but Tim Bundy, raised a point that I hadn't thought of before, and that is in relation to the inspections, that in other areas where you do have somebody doing a safety inspection, they are certified as being an inspector. They have some minimum amount of accreditation or education or training in relation to safety inspections. Previously, are you aware, or were there any of those accreditation requirements for these people doing the safety inspection?
Mr. Chairman, to the best of my knowledge, no, there were no requirements on the qualifications of the people doing the inspections. It was up to the insurance company or the trade association or whoever to determine the qualifications of the people that they employed.
If I could continue, Mr. Chairman, does it seem logical? Is he making a valid point that there should be some requirement, if we're going to allow for inspections, to have some sort of basic minimum accreditation? That, in other words, it's not just Joe walking in saying, yeah, this is a good program, looks fine by me, and then you've got your safety inspection approved or safety program approved.
Mr. Chairman, that that does have logic to it, and we pride ourselves on running a very good safety program and hiring competent people, and we would not object to having that kind of requirement. If that's what it takes to get the authorization to go back into an aggressive safety program, we're all for it. Let's get on with it.
Thank you very much.
No, Mr. Chairman, sorry I missed out on the previous testimony. I was just wondering, the last time we heard these two bills, I thought the direction that we gave was you guys sit down and work something out between the two bills and bring it back for us. Whatever happened to that idea? I thought it was a pretty good idea at the time.
It's still a good idea. It hasn't happened. Governor Mulder promised me it would by tomorrow, though.
And I'm going to move Mount Juneau across the way. If I could respond.
Representative Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mackey. Through the interim, at the encouragement of many of us, there was impaneled a task force, an ad hoc task force, which had representatives from the management side, the employer side, and organized labor. And as everyone is aware, there really are three legs in this stool to be able to reach compromise, and that is those employer groups, organized labor, as well as the insurance providers. Speaking in the world of political reality, as Mr. Hutchins referred, any of those three groups basically have the ability just about to veto or to stop any efforts in this legislature. There was a compromise that was put forth by the task force. It was deemed not workable, not totally workable yet by the insurance carriers. I know they were very interested in still looking at it and trying to work out some provision to make it more acceptable. But at this point in time, there has not been compromise reached that all three parties are acceptable with. 241 was introduced basically not because I wanted to introduce a separate piece of legislation, but as much as 64, the title for 64 was too tight to be able to make amendment to it. And we felt that while the two issues may not necessarily be tied, they have been tied politically and historically through this legislature for the past 5 years. And that being a reality, both issues have merit. Both are worthy of consideration. And I share Mr. Hutchins' opinion that I hope we can come to some compromise, some agreement. I know members of organized labor have that sincere desire as well, and I credit them with going above and beyond the call of duty to try and make accommodation. And I also credit the insurance companies for trying and the management groups. And I think anything that we can do as individuals as a committee to encourage them to try and press on would be fortuitous. The problem with putting the bill forward right now is that I believe the bottom line is if we put it on the floor, no package as it currently exists would pass. And we'd spend a lot of time and lose a lot of blood for something that probably would not pass the legislature. So that is why I've not really encouraged anything to press on. It just doesn't seem to be fortuitous for our efforts, given our limited amount of time.
Can I ask one other question, Mr. Chairman? Okay, I can really appreciate that. I know I've been in that kind of a situation before where you come to a loggerhead and there's not much else you can do. Number one, I wouldn't be interested in seeing legislation that was bad for the workers of Alaska. But one thing that, you know, I mean, there's obviously a problem out there, otherwise the bills wouldn't be before us. What happens if we do nothing? I mean, if we continue to say, well, either come together or we don't do anything, which obviously has happened, what situation does that place us in from a public policy standpoint?
From a policy standpoint, I think it'd be preferable if we did have workplace safety programs. But from a policy standpoint, I also strongly believe that the health benefit extension is good public policy. It's unconscionable to me, the concept that a person will work for an employer, and then once that employee becomes injured, that the health benefits for their family are terminated just because their employee, so in essence they're walking away from their obligation to their employee. So I think they both have merit. From the standpoint of if we do nothing, what will happen? Some people are doing workplace safety programs currently, assuming the risk, the financial risk. Some companies have suspended them, such as Eureka. Alaska National Insurance, I understand, when talking with their owner or one of their owners, indicated to me that they were going to begin getting insurance to cover themselves. They were going to look at ways to cover their exposure for any kind of liability they may have with either past actions or current actions that are ongoing. In relation to the employer groups, there again, some are going to do